July 8, 1997, Carson City, Nevada. While visiting her father, 16-year-old Natasha Jennings is found dead inside a bedroom at his apartment. An electric fan is lying over Natasha's body, her hair is damp, and even though traces of cocaine and methamphetamine are inside Natasha's nostrils, no drugs are found in her system, and the medical examiner cannot determine her exact cause of death. There are a few theories involving foul play, including the possibility that Natasha was murdered because her father was a drug informant, but these are never substantiated, and no one can figure out how Natasha died. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today I'm going to be covering a perplexing case in which no scenario seems to make sense. The unexplained 1997 death of Natasha Jennings. This story was featured on one of the later episodes of Unsolved Mysteries, and I consider it to be one of the more underrated segments, because while it is not a heavily discussed case, it is definitely a major head-scratcher. Natasha Jennings was a 16-year-old girl who decided to spend a few weeks staying with her estranged father, as she had not seen him in many years, and was trying to rekindle the relationship. But tragically, Natasha would wind up dead inside her father's apartment under very mysterious circumstances. One of the strangest aspects of this case is that there were small traces of drugs found in the apartment and inside Natasha's nostrils, but there were no actual drugs found in her system. This seemed to rule out the possibility of her being the victim of a drug overdose, but the problem is that no one could actually tell how she died. There were a couple of theories pushed forward about Natasha's death being a homicide, but even if foul play did take place, how exactly did the perpetrator kill her? Over the past 25 years, Natasha's mother has fought diligently for answers, and has always been very critical about how the local authorities have handled the investigation, but their argument is that there just isn't much in the way of evidence to work with, and nothing that conclusively proves that a crime took place. Another possibility is that Natasha succumbed to some sort of freak medical issue that no one had been able to figure out, but that's all just speculation as well, and there doesn't seem to be any one theory in this case which makes 100% complete sense. So on this episode, we're going to explore all the different angles and try to figure out what happened. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the unexplained death of Natasha Jennings. Our story begins in 1997, and our central figure is 16-year-old Sadie Natasha Jennings, who goes by her middle name. Natasha was originally born in Carson City, Nevada, to her father, Clarence Jennings, and mother, Tammy Stetson, who had an older daughter from a previous relationship named Delilah Perrazzo. However, on April the 8th, 1982, when Natasha was just over 1 year old, her family would experience a major tragedy when Delilah was killed in a house fire at the age of 3. It was around this time period when Clarence and Tammy got divorced and Tammy got full custody of Natasha and moved back to her home state of California. At this particular point, Natasha is living in the town of Brea and has not had any contact with her father since she was a toddler. While her parents' divorce had a major impact on Natasha as she was growing up, she was described as being a positive, outgoing, and caring person who could instantly make friends. By the time she reached the age of 16, Natasha wanted to reconnect with Clarence, and while Tammy was opposed to the idea at first, she ultimately decided that she did not want her own personal issues with her ex-husband to deprive Natasha from establishing a relationship with her father. So when the summer of 1997 rolled around, Tammy agreed to let Natasha return to Carson City for a two-week visit with Clarence. Oddly, before she left California, Natasha also seemed to give off the impression that she had experienced some sort of bad premonition. She asked the minister at her church to baptize her, and also asked her mother a number of questions about God and what she wanted for her out of life. When Natasha boarded her flight to Carson City, she made the strange decision not to look back at her mother and friends as they were waving goodbye to her, and this would turn out to be the last time they ever saw her alive. After she arrived, Natasha spent the next couple of days staying at her father's apartment, which he shared with his sister, Sandra. At around 1 p.m. on the afternoon of July the 8th, Natasha had lunch with her aunt at the apartment before Sandra left. Natasha was then supposed to go out and meet up with her father, but she never showed up, and even though Clarence tried calling the apartment several times, he was unable to reach Natasha and left numerous messages on the answering machine. Sandra eventually returned home and answered one of Clarence's calls, so he asked her if Natasha was there. Sandra put down the phone and started searching through the apartment and went upstairs to check the bedroom Natasha was staying in. When she went inside, Sandra let out a scream when she discovered that Natasha was lying on the floor. Sandra ran back to the phone and told Clarence she found Natasha and that she wasn't breathing, so she quickly hung up and called 911. By the time the paramedics arrived, Natasha was pronounced dead at the scene. The circumstances of Natasha's death were very strange, as a standing electrical fan had fallen over and was lying on top of her body. Even though she was clothed, Natasha's hair was damp, which suggested that she had recently bathed or taken a shower. There are differing accounts about a towel found at the scene, as the Carson City Chief Deputy Coroner Eric Cantlin would state that it was found wrapped around Natasha's head. However, Day Williams, an attorney whom Tammy later hired, would tell the media that the towel was actually on Natasha's shoulders in the police photographs. Many sources, such as the Unsolved Mystery segment, will tell you that there were no obvious signs of trauma on Natasha's body to indicate that a homicide had taken place. But in an article published in the June 6, 2001 edition of the Reno Gazette Journal, Tammy stated that Natasha had broken teeth, a gash on the back of her head, and a broken arm. As far as I can tell, these details have never been publicly corroborated by law enforcement, but Tammy alleged that the authorities ignored them when they took the report. After an autopsy was performed on Natasha, it failed to provide any insight into what actually killed her, but the chief deputy coroner did not believe there was any direct evidence of foul play. As a result, Natasha's death was officially classified as undetermined, and her cause of death was simply left blank on her death certificate. The case would be investigated by the Carson City Sheriff's Office, and according to Chief Deputy Scott Bureau, even though there were no obvious signs of foul play, they still had to initially treat Natasha's death as a potential homicide unless the evidence pointed them in a different direction. One angle that they explored involved a 26-year-old man whom Natasha became acquainted with, and even though his real name has never been released publicly, Unsolved Mysteries referred to him as Chris, so that's what I'll be calling him here. After she arrived in Carson City, Natasha quickly made some new friends, and 3 days before her death, she attended an impromptu party they held. Chris also attended this party, and those who consumed a lot of alcohol were told they could spend the night at the residence instead of driving home. The following day, Natasha made a phone call to Ingrid Kotar, her best friend in California, who said that Natasha seemed confused and traumatized. According to Ingrid, Natasha told her that she had drank so much at the party that she blacked out and believed that Chris raped her. Following Natasha's death, Chris was questioned by the Carson City Sheriff's Office. They were unable to corroborate the story about the alleged sexual assault, as no witnesses could confirm having seen anything happen between Natasha and Chris at the party. I'll be addressing this statement later on in this episode, but during his Unsolved Mysteries interview, Scott Bureau said, quote, "The autopsy report was conclusive that she was not sexually assaulted," end quote. In the end, investigators found no evidence to suggest that Chris had any involvement in Natasha's death. Since the police investigation did not seem to be going anywhere, Tammy traveled from California to Carson City in order to do her own independent investigation. She attempted to speak to anyone who had interacted with Natasha during her time there, and posted and handed out thousands of flyers about the case. While she was passing out flyers at a shopping center, Tammy said she was approached by a woman who told her she knew what happened to her daughter. According to Tammy, the woman appeared to be frightened and was constantly looking over her shoulder until she provided her phone number and asked her to call for information. Tammy soon phoned the woman, who revealed that Natasha had been killed because her father was a confidential drug informant for local law enforcement agencies. When Clarence's cover was blown, some drug dealers decided to murder Natasha as retribution. While the Carson City Sheriff's Office and the Nevada Division of Investigation and Narcotics both maintained that there was no documentation to indicate that Clarence was a drug informant, and he completely denied these allegations as well. However, Tammy claimed that when she and some other relatives confronted one of the detectives assigned to Natasha's case about this, he did confirm that Clarence was an informant. Whatever the case, there was speculation that Natasha's death was somehow connected to drugs. Following the discovery of her body, investigators found a small scrap of plastic on a landing on the stairs outside Natasha's bedroom, which had traces of methamphetamine and cocaine on it. Minute traces of these two drugs were also found inside Natasha's nostrils. Dr. Cyril Wecht, perhaps the most famous forensic pathologist in the United States, was interviewed about the case during the Unsolved Mysteries segment, and his conclusion was that Natasha may have ingested some drugs which caused her body temperature to increase to an abnormally high level, and she wound up experiencing a bout of hyperthermia. Weck theorized that the reason Natasha's hair was damp was because she had taken a bath in an attempt to make her body cool down, but suddenly collapsed and died of a spasm while she was in the midst of drying her hair. However, the big issue with that theory is that even though small traces of drug residue have been found inside Natasha's nostrils, the medical examiner found no actual traces of drugs in her system during the autopsy. In addition, Tammy maintained that her daughter never would have taken drugs such as cocaine or methamphetamine. In fact, the flyers that she passed around for Natasha contained this message, quote, "Her good name and good character were defamed through claims that she had taken a drug overdose or had committed suicide, because drugs were found in the house. No drugs, however, were found in her system," end quote. In March of 1999, a multidisciplinary child death review group from various agencies held a meeting in Carson City in order to review Natasha's case, but they were unable to come up with any conclusive answers about how she died. Tammy openly stated that she believed that the meeting was a joke and argued that a forensic pathologist should have been present for her attorney, Day Williams, to question. Williams had offered his services to Tammy after seeing one of her flyers about Natasha and agreed to work for her pro bono in order to press the authorities to perform a more thorough investigation. In August of that year, Tammy filed a petition in Carson City District Court to seek a grand jury investigation into Natasha's death, as she believed that important facts had been covered up or left undiscovered by an inadequate law enforcement investigation. She openly directed criticism towards Carson City District Attorney Noel Waters, claiming that he only spoke to her on one occasion following her daughter's death, but would not return any of her phone calls or respond to any certified letter she sent him requesting a coroner's inquest. She also wanted both the district attorney's office and the sheriff's office to be investigated for possible misconduct or cover-up. Tammy stated, quote, "It would be a blessing if we found that Natasha died of natural causes, but when no one will talk to us, it makes us suspicious," end quote. For his part, Waters confirmed that law enforcement had already checked out a number of leads that Tammy provided, such as the allegations that Clarence was a drug informant, but did not find any merit in them. He stated, quote, "After running down or attempting to check out a number of such questions by Miss Stelton, I now question her credibility. I have not requested a coroner's inquest in this matter because I have no basis to believe it will add anything to what we now know about Natasha's death. The pathologist still doesn't know precisely how she died. He only knows she did not die of choking, stabbing, strangulation, shooting, overdose of common drugs of abuse or alcohol, or drowning, or any other evident manner of homicide. The Carson City Sheriff's Office still had no evidence anyone bore this child any ill will or malice during the brief time she was in Carson City, nor is there yet any evidence of another person's involvement. End quote. Shortly after Tammy's petition for a grand jury investigation was filed, it was denied by a pair of district judges, who said that Nevada law only allowed Nevada taxpayers to petition the assembling of a grand jury, and Tammy was not eligible to do so since she resided in California. The judges also ruled that the petition was defective because it asked the grand jury to look into a public official not properly doing their job, but Nevada law only allows grand juries to look into financial matters such as the misappropriation of money and fraud. In addition, they believed that assembling a grand jury for this matter would be too expensive, and Noel Waters concurred by saying, quote, "I'm not going to spend taxpayers' money to say we don't know how she died and that we don't have the evidence it was by another party." End quote. This decision was appealed to the Nevada Supreme Court, who also rejected Tammy's petition for a grand jury, but she attempted to get around this by enlisting the assistance of a Carson City resident named Karen Perdue, the wife of a retired Los Angeles police detective and mother of two daughters of her own. After learning about Natasha's story in the media and coming across one of the flyers about her death, Karen decided to call up Day Williams and ask if she could be of assistance to Tammy. Since Karen was technically a Nevada resident and taxpayer, she agreed to file a new petition for a coroner's inquest on Tammy's behalf, but a district court judge still dismissed the request on technical grounds. In spite of this, the case would garner national exposure when it was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired in August of 2001. Scott Bureau agreed to be interviewed on the show, stating, quote, "We will cooperate in any way we can, but airing this death on television is not going to change the fact that the forensic pathologist cannot find a cause of death. The publicity may help garner additional witnesses and be used to develop new leads and information, but we're still in a quandary as to the cause of death." End quote. During her own interviews in the segment, Tammy continued to express her belief that her daughter had been murdered, and Bureau addressed the situation by saying, quote, "The unfortunate part is, I don't have an answer for the mother. This girl was 16 years old. She had her entire life ahead of her. And we don't have any answers. We don't have the bottom line." End quote. Unfortunately, the show failed to bring about any new leads which shed any further light on Natasha's death. On July the 31st, 2008, Clarence Jennings passed away at the age of 52, and while this hasn't been confirmed by any official media outlet, you'll find a lot of sources online which state that his death was a botched suicide brought upon by an attempted drug overdose. So after nearly 26 years, the actual circumstances of Natasha Jennings' death continue to remain an unsolved mystery. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So I've covered quite a few cases on this podcast in which a victim's death was ruled to be a suicide or an accident, but their loved ones were convinced it was murder. And of course, Unsolved Mysteries has definitely featured a lot of stories like this, some of which it seemed that the victim's death was not a homicide, but their loved ones were in denial and pushing forward a foul play narrative in order to help them deal with the grief. But the Natasha Jennings case stands out because there are just no conclusive answers at all about how she died, and it fits the definition of the phrase, unexplained death. Regardless of whether you believe Natasha's death was the result of a homicide, a drug overdose, or some sort of freak medical issue, you really can't blame her mother, Tammy, for refusing to let this go, because she has just never received any answers. While Tammy definitely believes that her daughter was the victim of foul play, she has said that if anyone could tell her that Natasha died of natural causes, and there was nothing anyone could have done to prevent it, she could have accepted that and moved on. I can certainly understand why Tammy would have a hard time dealing with this, because she was reluctant to allow Natasha to reconnect with her estranged father, Clarence. But Tammy gave in and allowed Natasha to travel to Carson City to stay with her father, and she wound up dying under his watch. I mean, if Natasha died as the result of some sort of medical issue, then it was likely going to happen anyway, regardless of whether or not she went to Carson City. However, if her death was somehow connected to her trip there, then I can only imagine the amount of guilt that Tammy must have been feeling and why she desperately needed answers. Now, no one has ever accused Clarence of being directly responsible for his daughter's death, but of course there has always been speculation that Natasha was killed because of something Clarence was involved in, or that he may have known more than he was letting on. There are issues with the theory that Natasha's death was a drug overdose, but that doesn't change the fact that a scrap of plastic containing remnants of cocaine and methamphetamine was found inside Clarence's apartment, which seems to imply that drugs were there at some point. Regardless of Clarence's actual complicity in what happened, everything I've read about him online does not exactly paint a flattering picture of him, but Natasha still wanted to attempt to form a relationship with her father. Clarence's death in 2008 has been described as an attempted suicide via a drug overdose, but we really don't know if this might have been brought on by guilt over his daughter's death. I know that Tammy has spent years expressing her frustration at what she perceives was an inadequate investigation from the Carson City authorities. The Unsolved Mystery segment stated that the investigation into Natasha's death is still officially open, but it might be one of those open cases where no one is actively working on it unless some new leads or information drop into their lap. If you search online, you'll find a blog about former Carson City District Attorney Noel Waters, which contains a number of posts which were written between 2008 and 2010, and direct a lot of criticism towards how he handled a number of cases in the Carson City area, including the death of Natasha Jennings. They claim that Waters did everything in his power to block a proper coroner's inquest into the case, and while his rationale for doing so was his belief that it would not turn up anything new about Natasha's death and be a waste of taxpayers' money, the blog alleges that Waters was attempting to cover something up and protect someone. The blog was also very critical of Carson City Chief Deputy Coroner Eric Cantlin, accusing him of spreading misinformation about Natasha in order to sully her reputation and give off the impression that she was responsible for her own death. In an article published in the Stockton Record on September 2, 1999, Cantlin said that prior to her death, Natasha had been drinking and socializing with a rough crowd, stating, quote, "She ran with a crowd I would not want my 16-year-old running with at all." He also expressed his belief that Natasha's death was a result of a rare hereditary heart problem, but acknowledged that he was unable to prove this. I personally don't believe that's an unreasonable statement, but then Cantlin made a bizarre comment about the 1982 death of Natasha's 3-year-old half-sister, Delilah Perrazzo. Even though Delilah had been killed in a house fire, Cantlin stated that there was not enough smoke in her lungs to conclude that she died of smoke inhalation. So why did Cantlin bring this up, and what is he implying here? Is he trying to say that Delilah also died from the same hereditary heart problem which he believed killed Natasha? I mentioned earlier that Tammy has made statements about Natasha having a number of injuries, such as broken teeth, a gash on the back of her head, and a broken arm, even though most sources report that she had no signs of trauma on her body. According to the blog, this discrepancy may be due to the fact that these injuries were not mentioned in the forensic pathologist report, but they are apparently visible on the original crime scene photographs. Of course, since I've never actually seen these photos, I cannot confirm or deny this. And while we're on the subject of law enforcement figures in this case, when Chief Deputy Scott Bureau agreed to be interviewed during the Unsolved Mystery segment, he was already a familiar face to fans of the show. Many years earlier, he had been interviewed in another segment because he was the lead investigator in the unsolved 1983 murder of Terry McClure, who was also found dead in Carson City. Bureau always believed that Terry's son, Tim McClure, was responsible for her murder, but when Tim was charged with the crime nearly a decade after the fact, a judge wound up dismissing the case with prejudice, meaning that Tim can never be charged again, no matter what. Since dismissing a murder case with prejudice is an incredibly rare occurrence, I've always wondered if the Carson City authorities screwed things up in a huge way, which may not bode well when you think about their investigation into Natasha's death. But as critical as Tammy may have been towards them, I can see things from the opposite perspective and understand that aforementioned quote that Bureau shared during the Unsolved Mysteries segment about the case. They would like to provide an answer for Tammy, but they just don't have one because no one can figure out how Natasha died. One of the biggest issues with believing that Natasha was the victim of foul play is that with the evidence we have, it's tough to figure out how someone could have actually murdered her. I just discussed the contradictory information about whether or not Natasha had injuries on her body, but even if she did have a broken arm, broken teeth, and a gash on the back of her head, I don't think these injuries alone would have been severe enough to kill her. But if the authorities know about these injuries and have neglected to mention them publicly, then I suppose this would lend credence to Tammy's allegations that a cover-up took place. However, in order to figure out what happened, we have to look at the timeline of events. The official narrative is that Natasha was last seen alive by her Aunt Sandra when they had lunch together at Clarence's apartment. After Sandra left, Natasha was supposed to go meet her father somewhere, but she never showed up, and when Sandra returned to the apartment sometime later, she found Natasha dead. As far as I can tell, it's never been reported that there were any signs of forced entry at the apartment, but I guess the alternate explanation is that Natasha could have willingly let her killer inside before they harmed her. Since Natasha's hair was damp, she obviously took a bath or shower a short time before she died, and we know that a standing electrical fan was lying on top of her body. If there was no foul play involved, then Natasha was likely standing right next to the fan and caused it to fall over when she collapsed. Given that Natasha was wet at the time, one theory which has been pushed forward is that the fan may have shorted out and Natasha was accidentally electrocuted, but I'm sure there would have been some sort of marks or burns on her body or something that showed up on the autopsy if this is what happened. The theory pushed forward by Dr. Cyril Wecht is that Natasha may have ingested some drugs which caused her to start suffering from hyperthermia, which, contrary to hypothermia, causes your body temperature to rise to an abnormally high level. If this is what happened, then Natasha may have taken a bath or shower to cool herself down, but without proper treatment, the condition could have been fatal. Now, the big flaw in Wecht's theory is that there were no traces of drugs in Natasha's system. One particular form of hypothermia which can be life-threatening is malignant hypothermia, which can be caused by exposure to such triggering agents as anesthesia. Malignant hyperthermia is also a genetic condition, though I've never seen any indication that anyone else from Natasha's family ever had it to make her more susceptible. I would be curious to know how thoroughly Dr. Wecht studied this case, because he is probably the most high-profile forensic pathologist in the United States, and has consulted on thousands of these cases. That's not to say that he's infallible, as I have not always agreed on Wecht's conclusions on every single case he studied, but if he's going to conclude that a deceased girl ingested drugs without any drugs showing up in her system, then he must have his reasons for this. Tammy was always adamant that Natasha never would have taken drugs, but of course every parent is going to try to paint their deceased child in the best possible light. Even if Natasha was a very good kid, that doesn't necessarily mean she wouldn't have decided to experiment a bit since she was making new friends in a new city while visiting a father whom she had not seen in many years. Well, here's a direct quote from Scott Bureau's Unsolved Mysteries interview in which he attempted to explain away the lack of drugs in Natasha's system. Quote, "If you snort cocaine on Monday and you're deceased on Friday and we do a toxicology test, we may find remnants of the drug, perhaps in the nose, or maybe in an injection point or something like that, but the actual toxicology of your blood and urine and whatnot may produce a zero amount." End quote. Well, I'm admittedly no medical expert, but I'm trying to figure out how that logic would work. After doing some research, I found that cocaine generally remains in your bloodstream for 1 to 2 days after you ingest it, while methamphetamine can last up to 3 days. But even if Natasha had tried those drugs days beforehand, I'm not entirely sure how they would provide such a delayed reaction and kill her after they've already left her system. Investigators found a small scrap of plastic containing traces of drugs on a landing on the stairs inside the apartment, but if Natasha overdosed, shouldn't a lot more drugs have been found near her body? I guess the alternate explanation is that if Natasha did have drugs in her possession, Sandra or Clarence could have gotten rid of them before calling for help, so they wouldn't have to explain the presence of drugs in their apartment to the authorities. Of course, we probably wouldn't even be talking about an overdose theory if traces of residue from cocaine and methamphetamine had not been found inside Natasha's nostrils. Well, the presence of the scrap of plastic does seem to indicate that drugs were being used in the apartment at some point, so is it possible that if Clarence, Sandra, or anyone else had been using drugs while Natasha was there, she could have unknowingly inhaled some remnants of dust or drug residue which were in the air? I read a 2014 study from the National Library of Medicine which stated that approximately 55% of children removed from homes that have methamphetamine labs test positive for toxic levels of chemicals inside their bodies, even if they have not taken any drugs themselves. I obviously do not believe there were any meth labs operating in Clarence's apartment while Natasha was staying there, but I do wonder if Natasha could have been exposed to any drugs during her time in Carson City and inhaled some drug residue without even realizing it. I did find an article from the February 24th, 1999 edition of the Reno Gazette Journal, which mentioned that there had been a rumor that Natasha visited a meth lab in the nearby unincorporated community of Mount House, but even though I have no idea if this rumor was true, it could provide a potential explanation for the meth residue inside Natasha's nostrils. But even so, how exactly did she die? Well, let's start talking about the potential scenarios involving foul play, as it sounds like two of them have been presented. Either Natasha's death was connected to a sexual assault she allegedly experienced at a party 3 days earlier, or she was killed because her father happened to be a drug informant. Of course, we don't have much information about this guy known only as Chris, who supposedly assaulted Natasha, and the only media outlet which really explored this angle was Unsolved Mysteries. The show featured a reenactment of the party which Natasha and Chris attended, and the actors who portrayed them looked like teenagers, but it was pretty unsettling to find out that Chris was actually 26 years old and was drinking and partying with someone like Natasha, who was only 16. So according to Natasha's friend Ingrid Kotar, she had phoned her up and said that she got drunk and blacked out of the party and believed that Chris had raped her, but I get the impression that Natasha wasn't 100% certain. But the way Unsolved Mysteries presents this whole situation is a bit confusing, because when Robert Stack mentions that police questioned Chris about this alleged sexual assault, he states, quote, "Detectives concluded that whatever may have happened between him and Natasha, his actions had not been criminal," end quote. This is then followed by an interview snippet from Scott Bureau, who states, quote, "The autopsy report was conclusive that she was not sexually assaulted." Okay, so is Bureau stating that the autopsy showed that Natasha was not sexually assaulted right before her death? Or did it also show that no sexual assault took place at the party? Because I'm not sure how a deceased girl's autopsy can conclusively prove she was not sexually assaulted days beforehand. How could it possibly tell the difference between rape and consensual sex unless there were some noticeable injuries? After all, we know that she took a bath or shower right before she died, and that would wash away potential forensic evidence. I suppose the only way an autopsy could debunk the idea of a victim having been raped is if it showed that Natasha was still a virgin when she died, but we don't know that information. However, even if Natasha really was sexually assaulted, did this actually play any role in her death? Well, the issue with this whole theory is that Natasha's death did not take place until days after the fact, and even though she told Ingrid about it, I see no indication that she was threatening to go to the authorities or press charges against Chris. As far as I know, there weren't any signs of struggle or forced entry at the apartment, and I have my doubts that Natasha would let someone who raped her inside. And if Chris wanted to murder Natasha in order to prevent her from speaking out about the rape, how did he manage to do so without leaving behind any obvious signs of foul play? I hearken back to the quote I shared from Carson City District Attorney Noel Waters, who said that Natasha, quote-unquote, did not die of choking, stabbing, strangulation, shooting, overdose of common drugs of abuse or alcohol, or drowning, or any other evident matter of homicide. So if Chris was the perpetrator, this would be a pretty sophisticated murder on his part. I think it's definitely possible that Natasha was the victim of a traumatic sexual assault during the last days of her life, but if so, I am inclined to believe that the angle is nothing more than a red herring and has no connection to her death. But what about the theory that Natasha was murdered because her father was a confidential drug informant? Well, the only reason this rumor got started in the first place was because Tammy was approached in public by a woman who told her this after recognizing Natasha's photo from one of her flyers. This woman's identity has never been released publicly, but I'd be curious to know if she had any sort of connection to Clarence, because if not, how could she have known this information to begin with? Now, law enforcement has always denied that Clarence was an informant, but even if he was, do you think they actually would have admitted it? I mean, I don't think it would have been in their best interest for Scott Bureau to openly confirm that Clarence was a confidential informant on national television, because not only would it potentially put his life in danger, but it might discourage other informants from working with these law enforcement agencies. According to Tammy, one of the detectives did confirm to her that Clarence was an informant before they started denying it, but if she is telling the truth, perhaps the detective wasn't supposed to share that information and caused law enforcement to go into full backpedaling mode. It's certainly possible that investigators did not want to seek answers about Natasha's death because they were worried it might interfere with a much larger investigation. The same scenario popped up in the episode I released a few weeks ago about the unsolved 1974 disappearance of Joanne Coughlin, as we had potential suspects who were prominent figures on the local drug scene, and you got the impression that the police did not want to solve Joanne's case, either because there was rampant corruption, or they feared it might jeopardize another serious investigation involving drugs. This is why Tammy has accused the Carson City authorities of orchestrating a cover-up. But one issue I have with the theory about Natasha being killed as retribution for Clarence being a drug informant is that she had spent the past several years living in California, and her father had played virtually no role in her life until she decided to travel to Carson City for a two-week visit. If Clarence was involved in the Carson City drug scene, how many of those people even knew he had a daughter from California to begin with? If they wanted to send some sort of message to Clarence, wouldn't it make more sense to target his sister, whom he was living with at the time, or perhaps even Clarence himself? What are the odds that after reconnecting with her father for the first time in several years, Natasha would be targeted over something drug-related which she had nothing to do with? Furthermore, it's also rotten luck that these killers would pay a visit to Clarence's apartment during a window of time when Natasha was there alone and neither Clarence nor Sandra were present. And once again, if this was a revenge murder, how exactly did they kill Natasha without leaving any noticeable trace of foul play behind? Did they force her to ingest some fatal drugs, which somehow showed up inside her nostrils, but not her bloodstream? Look, I'm not saying that Clarence was a saint, or denying the possibility that he was involved in drugs during this time period, but this informant theory really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. However, out of all the theories which have been presented in this case, I can see why this one has gained a lot of traction, because there really is no explanation which makes 100% complete sense. This is why I can't help but wonder if Natasha succumbed to some sort of weird medical condition which no one has ever been able to detect. I know that Eric Cantlin expressed his belief that Natasha suffered from some sort of rare hereditary heart problem and equated the situation to an adult version of sudden infant death syndrome, where hundreds of babies per year just suddenly die while sleeping and no one can understand why. I really don't know what kind of medical condition could strike a 16-year-old girl in that fashion and cause her to die for unknown reasons, but that's not to say it couldn't happen. If so, it's obviously not something which showed up on any autopsy. I guess an alternate possibility is that Natasha did ingest something which proved fatal, but it was not your standard drug like cocaine or methamphetamine and did not show up on your standard autopsy. The aforementioned blog about Noel Waters did state that the Carson City Sheriff's Office never tested Natasha's body for signs of poisoning, so maybe there was something fatal in her system which has flown completely under the radar. I guess I can't completely discount the possibility of foul play, but this is definitely one case where it's almost impossible to come up with a concrete theory for what happened. I know that Natasha's mother definitely believes there was foul play, and I can definitely understand why she would cling to that scenario, because then someone could potentially face justice for this crime, and there would be a resolution. If Natasha's death was the result of a rare medical condition, then it might be impossible to ever find that out for sure, and Tammy would never receive answers. I guess the only way to resolve this for certain is if Natasha's death was the result of foul play, and there's somebody out there who knows something and can come forward. So if you happen to have any information on the death of Natasha Jennings, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, we released a top 10 list theme bonus episode where I count down the top 10 biggest surprise twists on Unsolved Mysteries. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discussed another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1994 murders of Michael Johnston and Rochelle Robinson. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Christy C. and George O. Thank you so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for another true crime podcast, Strictly Stalking.
Hey guys, I'm Jamie Beebe.
And I'm Jake Deptula.
We're the hosts of the true crime podcast, Strictly Stalking, brought to you from Podcast One.
Each week, Strictly Stalking gives stalking survivors the platform to share their stories in their own words.
Do you know why survivors refer to stalking as murder in slow motion? Have you ever felt like you were being hunted by a stranger? Would you know where to turn if a stalker was living in your house and you didn't know?
We're bringing you these stories to raise awareness about stalking and give you the resources to know what to do if you or someone you know is being stalked.
So tune in to Strictly Stalking each week as we dive into the largely unknown crime of stalking.
Listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite true crime podcast.
Of course, later this year, The Trail Went Cold will be in attendance at two separate CrimeCon events. The first one is CrimeCon UK, which is returning to London, and will be held at the Tower Bridge Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa on June the 10th and the 11th. And 2 months after that, I'll be attending the regular CrimeCon event, which will be held from September the 22nd to the 24th, at the World Center Marriott in Orlando, Florida. Our podcast has a specialized promo code which can be used to get a special 10% discount on tickets, and this time around, the same code is valid for both events. So in order to purchase tickets and get a 10% discount, you can either visit crimecon.co.uk or crimecon.com and use the special promo code COLD23. That's COLD23. And if that wasn't enough, I will also be in attendance at this year's True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place from August the 25th to the 27th at the DoubleTree by Hilton Hotel in Austin, Texas. For more information about that event, please visit their website at truecrimepodcastfestival.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. And of course, I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶